Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
These discussions with paramilitaries were at play with death.
Remarkable personal stories from around the world.
They don't speak with words, they speak with guns.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, China under pressure from the US over the ways it supplies items used for Russia's war in Ukraine. We lift the lid on how some of these transactions might be taking place.
There are some transactions that the Russians would do with Chinese businessmen or Chinese businesses that could conceivably go through the U.S. financial system using U.S. dollars.
Also, Egypt gets a good report from the IMF a month after getting an $8 billion support program. But how does that country keep going with very high levels of debt and inflation? Plus, Toronto is on a mission to improve its nightlife.
What's the best thing about it, then?
I think our music. Because we're such a diverse, multicultural city, we get a lot of, like, Afro beats, like, Brazilian funk, like, just a lot of different cultures coming together. So I think the music is the best here.
And what can the world's largest 3D printing factory actually produce? And remember, you can email us at any time on world.business@bbc.co.uk. Now, the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has told the BBC the United States is prepared to take steps against China if it continues to supply Russia with items used for its war in Ukraine. He was speaking at the end of a visit to Beijing in which he held talks with China's President Xi Jinping. At a press conference at the end of the visit, Mr. Blinken was quite clear about his concerns about China's dominance in certain areas of technology.
Solar panels, electric vehicles, and the batteries that power them. China alone is producing more than 100% of global demand for these products, flooding markets, undermining competition, putting at risk livelihoods and businesses around the world. Now, this is a movie that we've seen before, and we know how it ends, with American businesses shuttered and American jobs lost. President Biden will not let this happen on his watch.
Antony Blinken. Well, we'll talk about solar panels a little bit later, but first, what has this visit achieved, if anything? I asked Anna Swanson, who's been covering the Blinken visit, for the New York Times.
I think the most important part of Secretary Blinken's visit this week was just to try to maintain some stability in the relationship and really try to keep the relationship from sliding into further conflict. Both sides really acknowledged today that there are a lot of very fractious, difficult issues. The two countries have, you know, very different national interests when it comes to many, many areas, but they still want to maintain clear communication. Communication to reduce the risk of any kind of miscalculation. And they're trying to work forward, you know, on some rather, you know, kind of smaller but still pragmatic issue areas, like having more communication between the two countries' militaries or having China do more to stop exports of the chemicals that are used to make fentanyl, of course, which is creating a drug crisis in the United States. So there was an acknowledgement of this, you know, overall kind of stasis and difficult nature of the relationship, but still, you know, some efforts to move forward on some smaller pragmatic areas.
Anna, we've been here before, though, in a sense, with negotiations going on at this kind of level, and not much has come from it. But now Secretary Blinken has actually had a meeting with President Xi. Does that suggest that perhaps these things are going forward a bit more seriously?
Yeah, I do think the sign of a very high-level meeting between President Xi and Secretary Blinken today was a positive sign. The Chinese kind of held out the prospect of that meeting until later on, you know, to see how earlier meetings would go. And so it was a signal that they went okay, I think. Also, the position of the relationship is really quite different than last year when Secretary Blinken came to China for the first time. That was right after the surveillance balloon had floated across the United States and the American public was really in an uproar and relations were really not doing very well at that point. So, you know, it's not the lowest low that the U.S.-China relationship has been in. Still, I think that, you know, there is really an acknowledgement that there are a lot of difficult aspects to the relationship right now. You know, China's support of Russia in its war in Ukraine, for one. Another is some of the economic policies that the United States is rolling out, like tariffs and controls on technology that China really doesn't like. And, you know, there's a sense that there's no real quick fix to some of those more intractable problems.
That's right. Interesting about the quick fix, because that certainly doesn't seem to be. And relations, it seems, are quite poor, certainly at a political level. In trade terms, is trade still going on at a reasonable level between the US and China?
It is, yeah. So it has dropped somewhat due to the tariffs that former President Trump put in place and that which President Biden has maintained. That really has affected trade flows. We have seen some companies pull out of China and reroute their supply chains. And actually, last year, China fell below Mexico as a source of U.S. Imports for the first time in many, many years. So there has been a notable shift. Still, it's one of America's largest trading relationships. And, you know, there's billions of dollars of trade, tons of products going back and forth between the countries. And I think American officials and Chinese officials really do value that economic relationship. And they're certainly trying to preserve trade in goods when in areas that aren't considered sensitive to national security.
Anna Swanson there. Well, one of the key issues for the US is the way in which China's banks have been involved in facilitating transactions with Russia, acting as middlemen to get around US sanctions. Jeanette Sanchez is a former head of policy and advisory at the Bank of China in New York. I asked her what the mechanism was that allowed Chinese banks to help Russian business.
What I would call is more of an informal mechanism outside of what the U.S. economy would detect. Otherwise, they would not really be able to do it. It would be through either transactions that would not use U.S. dollars. It would be the use of complex financial structures where there would be some type of lack of connection or divertment of connection between China and Russia just to kind of evade the clarity of the transaction. The way that the transactions are being made through between Russia and China are in ways that would specifically not, I wouldn't say directly be evade sanctions, but that would not create a U.S. sanctions nexus presently.
I've been hearing that there are these temporary companies set up in order to enable the payments to be processed. An intermediary is from Hong Kong, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, UAE. Is that what's going on?
Yes, that is exactly the type of transactions that are taking place and that would enable then for the activity to go through without necessarily being detected directly through the U.S. financial system.
So just so it's clear, what happens is the Russians will then set up these temporary companies in those sort of countries, do the transaction, and then those companies do the transaction with Chinese banks. Is that how it works?
There are some transactions that the Russians would do with Chinese businessmen or Chinese businesses that could conceivably go through the U.S. financial system using U.S. dollars, but those would be using these temporary companies but that would go through Kazakhstan or Turkestan and those countries that where the transaction in its plane, in the way that they would be looked through the SWIFT system or the banking system, it would look as if it's a legitimate transaction that has no connection with Russia. But in the second phase of a transaction, the goods would then be sent to Russia. That would be one way. Alternatively, there would be a way in which China and Russia are dealing directly, but those transactions would be completely outside of the U.S. Financial system with currency that is not the U.S. dollar and so on.
So potentially doing the operations in Chinese yuan, for example.
Exactly, exactly. So it's as if Chinese financial institutions and Chinese businesses may maintain, I would think, two separate books, no? And Russia, no? Russia would deal with them through either these corporates that would be in different countries and would have kind of two types of phases of transactions where the end use is Russia, but not the first part of transaction. And or then the second set of books where the transaction is more direct but does not have a contact to the U.S. financial system.
Judette Sanchez there. Well, let's have a look at one of the key issues at the heart of the China-U.S. tensions on trade. I'm talking about solar panels. Now, China accounted for 83% of the world's solar panel production, and the U.S. less than 2%. That was in 2023. Chinese-produced solar panels are driving prices to record lows in the U.S., a boon for renewable energy supply developers, but a threat to solar manufacturers trying to create a domestic supply chain for the country's fastest-growing source of electricity generation. Now, there's been a change in all this because one of the big companies in the U.S. that had previously been producing items to put together for solar panels has now announced it is resuming that. Let's talk about that with Yogi Goswami, an engineering professor at the University of South Florida who spent decades on working with solar energy. Yogi, thanks for being with us. This is a pretty significant announcement, this new or really revived manufacture of what goes into solar panels.
Indeed. And that's a welcome announcement because years ago, China played dirty, and they reduced the prices below their costs, and that led a lot of companies to go bankrupt here.
But now that's changed. So, I mean, is there more that could be done to keep this going? In other words, to boost U.S. manufacture of solar panels, what could be done?
Well, there in fact needs to be done a lot more, and that is all of the companies that I think are going to make announcements of manufacturing in U.S., that whatever support they need, not against the WTO rules, but things like loan for setting up large manufacturing and so on, I think the U.S. government and others could help them in that way.
So could you see a moment where the U.S. actually could beat China in solar manufacturing?
If Chinese people played fair, yes. But
what do you mean by fair? Could you just what are you saying when you say fair? What do you mean?
Well, see, over there, it's the Chinese government that controls everything, and they are the ones who tell them, okay, you sell it at this price, which may be below their cost, but the manufacturers are not worried because they will be compensated in some other way. So that's what I mean, unfair practice.
So America would have to be unfair in order to beat that.
So as long as the game is fair, that companies stand on their own, they have their costs and they make profit, and at certain profit they sell, I think then U.S. can easily beat China.
Okay, thanks for that. Yogi Goswami there joining us live on the line from Florida. Now, let's talk about what's been going on the markets. Chris Lowe joins us, Chief Economist, FHN Financial, based in New York. Chris, thanks for being with us once again. I mean, this has been an amazing week in terms of U.S. data, some of it quite surprising. Could you just give us a sense of what we now know about the U.S. economy?
Yeah, Roger, I tell you, the biggest surprise this week was on the inflation front, and that was the Fed's preferred inflation measure, the PCE deflator, reported, and much higher than expected in the first quarter, which caused significant movement in markets. I think the most important thing is now only one rate cut fully priced into the market this year, and that not until December.
So, talking of the Fed, I guess you've probably seen there have been stories floating around today suggesting that Donald Trump's team are considering changes, if they get into power, that could actually limit the independence of the Fed. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I would say that I understand where it's coming from. Trump cut taxes, and the economic impact of that was undercut by rate hikes by the Fed. But that is the Fed's job. In other words, they set interest rates not to fight the White House, but to ensure that inflation stays under control. And that's what the Fed did. Beyond that, I would simply say that while the Fed has made mistakes, it has functioned better in the last 40 years than in the decades before that. And that's because after Richard Nixon, the Fed has effectively been independent, and it works better.
Okay, let's also talk about some of the big earnings out this week. I mean, it's interesting because we saw Microsoft, of course, coming out looking pretty good, really. In the tech sector, generally, things are looking good apart from Intel. But interesting, on the other hand, you've got Exxon and some of the oil majors not looking so good. So just give us a feel of that.
Yeah, so mixed bag, obviously. I mean, you look at the week as a whole. Markets perform pretty well, which, considering we're talking about less rate cuts from the Fed, that tells you that in general we like the earnings. But this is very much a function of, I think, U.S. fiscal policy,
yeah.
Which they're stepping on the conventional energy companies and encouraging things like technology and green energy instead. Yeah. And it shows in the earnings.
Chris, thanks as ever for joining us. Chris Lowe there of FHN Financial in New York. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service.
I knew right at that moment that my whole life was gone. I'm going to jail for a very, very long time. There was no doubt about it.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast with astonishing personal stories from across the globe.
And honestly, even at that point of reporting to a journalist, I don't think I really knew that that was in itself an act of whistleblowing.
Expect the unexpected.
The only future is death here. So if we live, we might have a chance. We will die anyway, but we will die trying.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now, Egypt's a country whose economy has been in deep trouble for many years, especially since the pandemic. It's had an $8 billion financial support program from the International Monetary Fund since March. And now the IMF has issued a report. It says Egypt's addressed a number of issues, including government recourse to central bank overdraft facilities and off-budget public sector activity. Meanwhile, the country is experiencing staggering levels of inflation. I've been speaking to Khalid Ikram, former director of the World Bank's Egypt department.
It's a vote of confidence with fingers crossed. Some of the issues that the IMF wanted, such as a devaluation of the exchange rate and so on, those have taken place. So their having occurred does give the IMF a bit more confidence. The problem with Egypt, and it's not only Egypt, it's with Pakistan and with other countries also, is that they enter into an IMF program, and as soon as the situation improves, I mean, you know, any lessening of the gloom enables them to cry hurrah and they back out of the program. Now, what has happened in Egypt is it was in pretty dire states. Then all this Middle East money, the Gulf money, I mean, Qatar's agreement and Saudi Arabia's impending agreement and rolling over of balances already in the on deposit in the central bank and so on took place. So suddenly the situation looks less dire to the Egyptians. So that makes me wonder how rigorously they'll follow through with the entire IMF wish list.
One area that isn't getting better is inflation. Inflation at the moment is pretty desperate in Egypt, isn't it?
It is. You see, actually, what bothers me is that I've been looking at the literature, and if things get really bad with inflation, and bad, these studies defined as an inflation rate of 40% a year for two consecutive years, then you'd get people coming out in the streets. And what bothers me is that the Egyptian rate is, the official rate is touching, 30, 33%. The price index that the Egyptians use, that gives a heavy weighting to the past. And so it tends to underestimate what's happening currently.
How is it possible for Egyptians to deal with this level of inflation, though? It must make living extremely difficult and the prospects of improving also very difficult.
Well, you see, that the prospect of improving is the real problem. Because once people's expectations about future inflation harden, I mean, that there's going to be a high rate of inflation, then it deters investment. It encourages people to agitate for wage increases and consequently feed more into the inflation. And those who are on fixed incomes or on pensions or something get absolutely desperate.
And that was Khalid Ikram speaking to me earlier. Now, improving Toronto's nightlife could provide a significant boost to the city's economy. That's according to the person responsible for transforming its nighttime economy. The city's making changes to allow more venues to stay open all night, moving away from its previous 2 a.m. last call policy and expanding beyond the downtown entertainment district. However, not everyone is on board. Our reporter in Toronto, Sam Gruitt, has been investigating how these changes are affecting the club scene.
What's the best and worst thing about Toronto's nightlife?
I think the worst thing is that people don't dance in Toronto. Everybody just stands around looking at their phone or like looking at their drink.
What's the best thing about it then?
I think our music. Because we're such a diverse multicultural city, we get a lot of like Afro beats, like Brazilian funk, like just a lot of different cultures coming together. So I think the music is the best here.
Yeah, I'm here to meet Charles.
Yeah. Oh, OK, yeah, you just walked in.
We're off to meet Charles Habouf, known in Toronto as the King of Clubs. He's the city's biggest nighttime venue owner, and we're here at his newest venue, Department.
Tell him 5 minutes, including yourself.
We have state-of-the-art sound. Lighting is state-of-the-art. It'll definitely be the biggest sound and lighting show in Canada.
Looking around, people are hard at work here. You've got the builders in getting it ready. What does it take to get a nightclub ready to open to the public?
A lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of imagination, and a lot of experience. You know, being in it exactly 40 years, I've done some of the best and biggest nightclubs in the world.
Things are changing in the nightlife industry in Toronto. How is that going to affect you?
Toronto and Ontario is still running with this 2 o'clock liquor license. I feel like we're being oppressed by all these old rules and regulations. And Toronto needs to catch up in order to compete on a global stage today. You need to be able to have a 4 a.m. license at minimum.
Charles predicts a 25% uplift in his sales once the liquor license rules change, which come into effect from January the 1st next year.
Toronto has been ready for the last 10 years to jump out of that box and say, here we are.
Hello?
Mirek Milan is one of the architects of the changes. He was Amsterdam's night mayor between 2012 and 2018, and now advises cities around the world.
What you've seen in cities around the world, once they really embrace nightlife and nightlife culture as one of their key cultural assets, you see that has billions of dollars of impact in the local economy. For example, Berlin, which is a city that is around about 3-4 million inhabitants. The nightlife economy there has an economic impact of 1.5 billion on an annual basis.
But not everyone is in favor.
We have music arenas, sports arenas, and it is the central tourist spot in Toronto.
Alain Colgrass lives in Toronto's entertainment district.
But we already have the major part of all this commotion and all this business and the economy. So let it go elsewhere in the city.
We're back outside the club on a Saturday evening. And for law students, Sarah, Jenna and Grace...
I like it. I don't know. I think it's good. I can't see any downside.
I feel like the one thing that is a problem is we don't have a really good transit system. Like, getting around, I feel like, is already kind of a disaster. So having to sort of, like, navigate, like, Uber, TTC or whatever, and now you'll be doing that at, like, 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. when people are, like, waking up and going about their day. I don't know. It just feels like some other things in Toronto need better planning to be able to facilitate.
Sam Gruitt out with the nightlife in Toronto there. Now, a giant 3D printer, big enough to make a house, has been unveiled at the University of Maine in the United States. The university says it's beaten its own record for the world's largest polymer 3D printer, with the new printer four times bigger than the previous machine. So, what would this be capable of? Joining me now is Dr. Eugene P., an expert in additive manufacturing at Brunel University here in the UK. Dr. P., thanks for being with us. First of all, I mean, the principle of a 3D printer is that you can effectively transmit objects over long distances. That's the theory, isn't it?
Yes, that's the theory, really. I think the theory really is that you can actually use a 3D printer to actually manufacture parts on demand, or you can actually manufacture parts somewhere that you might be far away from overseas, or it could be just in time manufacturing. I think it's just fascinating for this technology, how far we have come with.
Well, indeed, because I mean, people have talked about it in all sorts of terms, in terms of suggesting also that you won't have to transport goods in the future, perhaps, or a lot of goods, which could just be moved by being printed. I mean, does a big development like this enormous printer, does that take that forward, perhaps to the point where that becomes possible?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that's really the holy grail of what 3D printers would be in the future. I believe that the ISS or the International Space Station, they really do have a 3D printer in there. So you might be surprised that actually you are actually beaming up the data and they are just printing them spare parts, tools, things that need to be repaired really on demand. And I think the real benefit is that you don't need to have an inventory or warehouse of items that might be redundant over time. So I think having 3D printing facilities really helps a lot for manufacturers, especially for end users as well.
Okay, so we've reached the stage of a really big printer. So the advantage of a really big one, presumably, well, tell me, what is it?
So I think the two really big advantages to having a big printer, I think one which is you can actually produce large-scale parts. It could be components that are really long, big, huge in volume, or you can actually nest multiple parts and print them in one go. So rather than printing low numbers in each time, you can actually print hundreds of them in each print. So I think, for instance, if you have, say, a photocopier with the kind of a duplex print system or service, you can actually print multiple times. I think that saves a lot, not just in terms of efficiency, but also in terms of sustainability. I think in one go, you could print multiple times. That saves a lot of energy as well.
They say they can print something as big as a house. Do you believe them?
Yeah, I think that's amazing. I think that's really the holy grail. Bigger gets better, isn't it? So that's where I think we might come to a point that how big do we actually want the printers to go?
What's the actual necessity in the end, I guess? Well, we'll find out. Thanks so much for being with us. That's Dr. Eugene P. of Brunel University, and that's it from World Business Report.
I knew right at that moment that my whole life was gone. I'm going to jail for a very, very long time. There was no doubt about it.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast with astonishing personal stories from across the globe.
And honestly, even at that point of reporting to a journalist, I don't think I really knew that that was in itself an act of whistleblowing.
Expect the unexpected.
The only future is death here. So if we live, we might have a chance. We will die anyway, but we will die trying.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.